How are we doing, everyone? This is Jake Welch. I'm your host of the PB&J Report. Reporting live, recording live here in Boulder, Colorado. I got my friends Preston Johnson, Salt Lake City, and Ben Wagner in the heart of BYU Dumb in Provo, Utah. Gentlemen, how are you doing this evening?
Doing pretty good, man. How are you?
I'm not wearing a shirt, if that's if that makes a difference. So I'm doing great. Just for all the lady listeners out there, just know that I'm not wearing a shirt, and it's a pretty good experience for everyone around me.
We just lost any listener that we did have for the 9 seconds.
All three of them. Point. All three of them.
All three of our listeners. Sorry, Mom. It's really anyway. Well, it's a good day here, I guess, for BYU fans alike, as BYU squeaked out a victory against Pepperdine in that cracker box gym that they're playing in this evening. Goodness
Seriously,
gracious.
That thing is tiny.
I'm pretty sure the Richards building like holds more people in those stands that are above the basketball courts up there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Smith Fieldhouse is definitely, I mean, we get 3 or 4 times what they get for volleyball games.
I think they said that the announced attendance of the volleyball game was significantly larger than that of the basketball game in Malibu.
Yeah.
But they do play basketball in Malibu, so I think that they win on that one still, even though they only had 10 people show up.
That's true. They're not in this hellhole that is Provo, Utah right now.
Yikes. Yikes. So anyway,
snow everywhere.
I've seen things and I've heard things, and it just makes me realize that I'm never going to go back there to live for an extended amount of time.
I want to say that's a good decision.
Yes.
Can we call that the big O tire decision of the evening?
Shout out to Greg Rubel.
Shout out to, love how he always so casually slips those in there for the game. So
I know.
Anyway, let's talk about this one real quick, and we can talk a little bit about the team afterwards. This first half was, one of the worst halves of basketball, maybe aside from that half that we had at Gonzaga. Just as far as shooting goes, I mean, we're like, 0-for-9 from three? Just couldn't get anything down. And we had obviously turned it on in the second half a little bit better. Tyler Haas has some great clutch baskets there down in the end. And then obviously Matt Carlino had that huge three to really seal the win, essentially. I mean, if it wasn't for that, then, I'm sure he wouldn't foul that guy shooting three. But do you guys see this as a good quality win? Or is it like, oh gosh, our team really isn't that good?
Well, it's just they've done this a bunch of times now. They did this against Pepperdine last time. I think this is their third win. This is their third double, comeback from a double-digit deficit this season. So for some reason, they keep getting into these big first-half holes where Haas won't shoot the ball. No one will shoot the ball well. Brock Zylstra will get 19 of the 20 minutes in the first half, and nothing happens. And in the second half, they finally get the lineup that works normally without Brock Zylstra, and they put the comeback on. So it's just they've done this again and again and again. And to me, this game, this is almost like a no-win scenario for them, because a win does really nothing for them, and a loss knocks them out of the NCAA tournament for good. So it's hard to look at this as anything other than like a survival mode for what happened in the second half.
Yeah, I agree with Ben. It wasn't anything more than that. And like you said, it really was just like a no-win situation. At halftime, the chatter started on Twitter, bubble team, they lose this, there's no chance. And I agree with it. If they had lost that game to Pepperdine, Pepperdine's not a good basketball team. And so it's actually really strange that they beat us. They were up 5 or something in Provo when they played us about 2 weeks ago at the half. And then we came back and destroyed them. I think we beat them by 30 in the second half, which it's kind of just a similar type of thing. We couldn't really hit our shots in the first half. I don't know. It's kind of just, it's weird that they can hang with us. I'm not sure what they have on us. It'd be interesting if that's just fluky and BYU's been lazy, or if, they, have a way to slow us down. If there was anything came, the bright spot of tonight is I think Brandon Davies played really well. It had been a while since he had a great game, and I thought he was better than he had been probably in the last,
month.
5, 6 games. Yeah, month even.
Yeah, I would say that's the best he's been since the injury. And you saw it. I mean, we talked about this last podcast we did about how he's been catching the ball in the post and kind of waiting, pump fake, spin move, pump fake, spin move, up and under, and gets – hits the bottom of the rim. And in this game, he was just getting the ball in the post in good position and then making his move right away. I think there was really only one or two times where you kind of saw that just dribble, and the one time the ball got stolen. Yeah. But I think for the most part, he was moving. We also saw him spin back when he's posting up on the right block to, or the left block to spin back towards the baseline which and uses left hand as a uses left hand to finish, which is something he has not been doing this year. He's basically always going back to the middle to use the right hand. So I thought there was a lot of improvement in his game, and one of the best games we've seen him play in a long time. And I think that gives you hope if you're a BYU fan that maybe Brandon Davies is back a little bit, because they're going to need him if they want to make if they even want to have any shot of beating Gonzaga and St. Mary's.
Yeah, I mean it's going to come down to those three, and I think it's getting off to a good start. And if we're going to beat St. Mary's or Gonzaga, it has to happen that way. And we started out great against St. Mary's the last time, but kind of just choked it down towards the end of that second half and just couldn't really sustain that lead for much longer there. So what's the key to BYU getting off to a good first half start? Is it making sure that the big three get good open looks and that they're taking good quality shots? Or is it just more of a team effort, everyone just, fighting for boards and just getting off to a good start? I mean, what's the key, do you guys think?
I going back to what I said before, I really just think it might have been a little fluky that they've had a couple first halves where I think they were, 0-for-9 from three tonight against Pepperdine, or nothing was falling. They weren't really bad looks. I mean, Carlino wasn't chucking 30-footers like he has in the past. with 20-something seconds on the shot clock. I thought a lot of those were fine shots. They just weren't going in. So to say, to get off to a good start, I think it's in our face. They need to make shots. And you get it to Davies down low, though, and get him rolling, because once he gets in a rhythm, he's the best player on the floor for BYU. For me, people would maybe argue it's Tyler Hawes, but I think Davies is more important to BYU as a team than Tyler Hawes is. And so I think it's just kind of, the basics. And so to get up to a key start against a team like, I think Gonzaga beat Loyola Marymount by 40 tonight on the road. I mean, they're too good. Right? I mean, I don't know if a good start's really going to help BYU in the end. I don't think we have a chance to beat Gonzaga on the road. But, Gonzaga might show up and be dull and be sleeping in the first half. And if we play all right, we can hang for at least a little while. And, stranger things have happened. But to go on what you're saying, I don't know. It's hard to pick out specific things that will guarantee a key start for BYU other than just, the obvious. Well, they got to make a couple threes. They can't shoot 0% for 20 minutes and expect to, be in a game against a Gonzaga or St. Mary's, let alone Pepperdine. I mean, we were down double digits to Pepperdine tonight. Like, that actually happened. So anyway, I'm curious if Ben has any different thoughts, but I think it's just the basic stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it is and why they keep coming out and kind of having bad first halves. And a big part of it seems to be something is in Tyler Hawes's head right now. There's kind of this argument going back and forth on Twitter with people about what's wrong with Tyler Hawes. He's had a couple of subpar games for him. He missed two free throws back to back in this game. He's had tonight, some free throw shooting. I mean, he's still shooting like 82% for the month or something, which is still pretty good. But I mean, he was shooting 95% for a good chunk of this season. So it's kind of a debate. Some people think he has mission legs, that, he just got back from his mission last year and maybe, it's starting to catch up with him. I don't know how much of that I buy. I mean, he came back like in April or May. He had 3 or 4 months before the season started to get back in shape, to play pickup games. I mean, I don't know how much I buy that it's mission legs. I think there may be some mental fatigue there, but I do think there's something kind of going on in his head right now, and maybe he kind of found his stroke again there at the end of the second half. I mean, he hit a couple threes, hit a couple big shots to really kind of help get BYU back in and kind of finally over the hump there. So I don't know. Maybe Tyler Hawes is back. Maybe he just had a little stretch there where he wasn't as good. But I think his play in the first half recently has not been particularly great. And that's something that BYU, I mean, they have to have those two guys score 20 points a game if they want to win games. I mean, the fact is that no one else on this team can be a big-time scorer, with the exception of Matt Carlino, who's so streaky that you can't really depend on him for 20 points a night.
Yeah. No, that's definitely true. I mean, Matt Carlino, I mean, I think we talked about this last week, and it's the same kind of situation where if he picks his spots and he shoots under control, I mean, he can make baskets. I mean, I think what was like 10 of 17 the other night, and it showed that, like, hey, if he can pick his spots, he was 2 for 2 from three, then he can be a good, effective scorer. But I mean, it really is a mixed bag with this guy. He's like a box of chocolates, I guess you could say. You just never know what you're going to get. Want to talk about it, and I'm glad to see him getting more minutes. Anson Winder
Yeah.
Hit two huge threes there in the second half to kind of bring it back. They had three steals on the night. Didn't really show up huge in the stat sheet anywhere else, but he's playing good D, and I'm glad that when he's coming in and taking shots, he's taking them with confidence. And it seems like he's kind of turned a corner here in the last few games.
One thing worth noting,
because I think we even mentioned on the podcast last week that we wish, you know, he could get more minutes. How David Rose is kind of just sat on playing Carlino and Cusick at point guard, and that's about it. But yeah, it's great to see a guy with confidence. And I actually think he was the guy who took it to the rim and ended up kicking it out to that Carlino three that put BYU up four right at the end. And so, yeah, he had a lot to do with that comeback. And I mean, we only won by two. So I mean, you could argue without his play, BYU loses tonight.
One thing I think Winder's really worked on is shooting the kind of corner three or the sort of deep wing three. I think he's really worked. I think he kind of realized everyone knows that's, you know, the corner three is the most efficient shot in basketball and all that. And it seems like he's really worked on that to me, because when he gets it in the corner and he goes up with it, he's shooting with a lot of confidence and they're going in. I don't know what his rate is, but it seems like he's shooting really well from the corner, from three. And I think maybe last year, a lot of his threes came, if you remember, he played a lot of minutes at the point guard last year. And I think a lot of his three-pointers came from the top of the key. And this year, he's kind of getting all of his three-point shots in the corner. And I think that's something that's really helping him to develop into a consistent three-point shooting threat, especially on a night like tonight when Brock Zylstra was like 0 for whatever he was from three, and Hawes was 0 for whatever he was from three in the first half. I thought Anson's threes really gave a boost when the team needed it and kind of turned the three-point shooting around for BYU.
Yep. It's I'm really curious to see how the rest of this season shakes out. And I think that everyone's kind of pointing to these games against St. Mary's and against Gonzaga as, hey, this is the turn. I mean, this is the, you know, this is the climax of the season. You know, either you make it or you don't. So we'll see what happens there. I think the Utah State game is interesting as well, because if I look at the schedule correctly, I think that's, I mean, it's right around those games where, and where's the BYU schedule? I think, I mean, it's, I'm trying to think if it's like right before or right after. So, I mean, getting a, you know, a good win against, you know, Utah State would help them, you know, like would give them more confidence going into, you know, these games a little bit later against St. Mary's.
Yeah, they go Utah State, St. Mary's, Gonzaga all in a row.
Yeah. So, I mean, a good win against Utah State, they're feeling good. And then, you know, you go on the road against St. Mary's and come back home against Gonzaga. I think those are three, I mean, probably, you know, the three most crucial games for us for our season. And I think it just starts with that Utah State game. Get out, you know, get a good win there, and then go on and take care of business.
That's a game they should come out fired up for, because that game at Utah State last year was a game BYU really should have won. And you actually think that if BYU had been playing Craig Cusick or Matt Carlino or Anson Winder at the point guard last year, they probably do win that game. I mean, I think Zylstra, that was game one of the Brock Zylstra experiment at point guard. I think he had like seven turnovers or something. So, I mean, I think that's a game BYU really should have won, and they didn't. So I think they're going to look to get that one back against Utah State. Hopefully they don't have I don't think that's a game they're going to have a slow first half for. I think they're going to be fired up for that one.
Yeah, they will. I think it's worth pointing out real quick before we move on. Whatever it was, Anson Winder couldn't get minutes. Maybe it's because he couldn't shoot the three. I mean, after tonight, he's actually shooting better percentage than Brock Zylstra. And so I'll ask a question, because it's of my opinion, and maybe I'm wrong, but Anson Winder does more for the team. If he can hit the three at the same percentage and rate than Brock Zylstra, he does more for the team than Zylstra can do. He's better defender. He's quicker and more athletic. He can actually get to the basket and create a little bit. Zylstra sure has more rebounds per game, but I mean, Winder has as many steals as Zylstra does on the year in about a third of the time and minutes. I mean, actually, it's less than a third, maybe 30% of the minutes. I don't know. I feel like the lineup they had at the end of this game against Pepperdine was the best five, to have Carlino, Winder, and then Haas playing the three. Austin
was in his four, yeah.
And so is the reason that Winder wasn't playing very much because he couldn't shoot threes?
Well, he was hurt.
It's not a huge sample size, but after tonight, he actually has a better percentage than Zylstra and his second best on the team next to Haas. And so if that really is the case, I just don't think he's that much worse than Brock Zylstra at all.
I think first off, he was hurt the first couple of games of the year and was a DNP's for an injury. And then he kind of got back and he was just getting spotty minutes, I think, trying to get his legs back under him. And I don't think that's, I mean, I do think recently he's played well every time he's been in the game. And I don't think it's unreasonable to look at it and say, is the team better off with Anson Winder playing? The thing about Brock Zylstra is that there are nights when Brock Zylstra brings it. You know, there are nights when Brock Zylstra has those 15 and 16 point nights where he shoots 4 for 5 or 3 for 4 from three with, you know, a couple of transition layups. But there's sort of no in between, it seems like, with Brock. You've either got that game or you've got tonight's game in which he's just an absolute liability on defense. He can't hit a shot even when they're wide open. He's getting charges and turning the ball over in the half court. So I almost think you should, if you're Dave Rose, you almost go with a, you start Brock Zylstra, and then you pretty much seem to know within the first 6 or 7 minutes whether or not he's got it. And if he doesn't have it, you got to go to someone else. I mean, I was pointing out on Twitter he played 16 of 20 minutes in the first half. I don't understand why you weren't maybe throwing Delgado out there. See if Delgado's got it. See if Cusick's got it. I mean, I don't understand why Zylstra played that many minutes in the first half when he clearly wasn't on.
Yeah, and you want, I mean, I guess it's one of those things where you kind of just wonder how long is it going to take for him to warm up. I think Winder got the majority of his minutes in the second half there,
yeah,
which was glad, and you're glad to see that, okay, good, he did make the adjustment eventually.
And that was the lineup that brought BYU back, was the one with Winder in it.
Yeah, and I think that's a tough decision for a coach to make, but, you know, I guess that's why he's making, you know, $500,000 more than I am right now, so... You know, and I'm okay with that. I'll be making that, you know, two or three years, you know, hopefully.
When you're the head basketball coach at CU.
Yeah. You got to move up. Ted Boyle's doing a pretty good job right now, but
you got to move up from the ranks of, you know, the rec league coaching, you know, coaching those 12 year olds.
This is the thing. I'm hoping that they'll look past my record right now. Because so far this season, my team is 0-6. We played in a real barn burner last week, though.
So you're more Randy Whitman than, say, I don't know, Phil Jackson. You're more Lawrence Frank.
Yeah, I'm more Lawrence Frank. I guess you could say that. But I don't know. My team is the least talented team on planet Earth, but we play with heart. And most of the times, the kids walk off the court with a smile on their face. So,
cool at least, story, is, bro.
Whoa, hey, it is a great story about me helping out with these kids and boosting their self-esteem and making sure that they feel great about their basketball games. Because, quite frankly, Mr. Stephen A. Smith, quite frankly, these kids are horrible. So, anyway. A lot better than the BYU. The BYU basketball team is a lot better, so I'm glad of that. I guess next week we got, or I guess on Saturday, Santa Clara. Ben, are you going to play Admiral Agbar for us and declare this a trap game?
I thought tonight was the trap game, actually, because Santa Clara. I mean, Santa Clara is like they've been okay this year. I mean, we know they had a great out of conference record. They've been a little less impressive in conference, but we handled them pretty well. In Santa Clara, I think we'll beat them at home. I think we're going to play them well at home. I don't think it's a total trap game. That being said, with this BYU team, pretty much every game's a trap game because you never know when they're going to come out and go 0-12 from the 3-point line in the first half. So who knows? But I think they're going to handle Santa Clara pretty well.
They should, especially after the scare they had tonight. I think they jump out to a big lead and hold on to it.
Yep.
There you go. Good deal. So. Look forward to those games next week with the BYU basketball team. Big news this week out of the football program was the new schedule, the 2013 schedule, which, honest to goodness, I don't think it can get any better than this. And a lot of fans, I mean, there's always going to be people complaining, and I think all of us know by now that regardless of what BYU does, what Tom Homel does, or what anyone in the football program will do eventually, someone will complain about it.
It'll never be as good as Lavelle.
I mean, and this is the thing that kills me, though. It wasn't even – I mean, things were good under Lavelle, but they weren't that great. If anyone remembers, like, his last four seasons, I mean, 96 was great. We went to the Cotton Bowl. Everyone was happy. But after that, this is the funny thing to me. Like, people forget that back in the 80s, a coach like Bill Snyder could have three consecutive, like, six-win seasons, and they'd be like, okay, you know, let's give him 5 more years, and I'm sure he'll figure it out. Nowadays, it's, all right, if you don't have a 10-win season within your first year and you're not going to a BCS game in your next year, then you're going to get fired.
Yeah.
And so regardless, you know, of what BYU could have done, it's I think it's the best schedule that they could have come up with. First of all, because there's some good quality games that are also winnable games. I'm talking about, you know, Virginia, Georgia Tech, Houston, Utah, Boise State. You know, those games are winnable, but also seen as like, oh, hey, these are teams from legitimate conferences. It's not, you know, an Idaho State, which actually we still do have on the schedule, which is nice, I guess, because that'll get us ready for Notre Dame. But I'm looking at the schedule right now, and I'm not seeing anything that I don't like.
Yeah, I mean, you look at one thing that I think people, including myself, have complained about since they've gone independent has been the home schedule, because it's been they've been playing all these good games on the road, and the fans basically get to watch Idaho get beat up at Lavelle Edwards Stadium. But you know, the home schedule's pretty good. I think five of the six games are games you get excited for. Texas, obviously, Utah. Those are, you don't even have to go into why Utah is a good game. Middle Tennessee State was 8-4 last year, and they beat Georgia Tech at Georgia Tech. So they're not a bad kind of, you know, they're a Sun Belt team, but they're not a bad Sun Belt team. Georgia Tech at home and Boise State at home. The Idaho State game is the only one that's really, you know, against subpar competition. There's going to be a fun home schedule. I mean, it actually makes you want to buy tickets.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Preston, I know that you didn't. Did you go to any games last year?
I did not.
Are you going to be going to any of these games this year?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a completely different story.
So would you be getting season tickets then?
We're considering it. It's a good question. I think it'd be worth it just because I think I'm going to end up wanting to go to at least three or four anyway. So, yeah, there's a good chance.
Yeah, and I mean, last year the Oregon State game, the blackout game was sold out, but the Utah State game, I think, I mean, I don't know about sold out, but it was full. The stadium looked full. And the Utah State
and
the game,
opener
the stadium
against
looked full.
Washington State.
Yeah, but it was empty by halftime. A lot of those games were not attracting fans. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but just from being in the stadium, it looked like the attendance was a little down last year.
Definitely.
Yeah. And so I think attendance is going to go back up. I think this is a great move for them. And then if you look at the schedule overall, they play five teams from BCS conferences plus Notre Dame plus Boise State. That's seven BCS quality teams, as it were. Seven of the 12 teams went to a bowl game last year. Middle Tennessee State didn't go to a bowl game, even though they were bowl eligible. So, eight of their 12 teams were bowl eligible last year. So it's as good of a schedule as you can imagine putting together. It's certainly better than the schedule they played in the Mountain West Conference, and it's definitely better than the schedule they've played the last 2 years.
So let's get a Ben Wagner, Preston Johnson, realistic/ we're going to be incredibly pessimistic view of the season so far. So based on what we've seen the last couple of years, we'll probably win the opener against Virginia. We'll win that game, right? Because we've won pretty much all of our openers the last few years. I think, you know, Broncos like 6-0 or something like that. I mean, going back to like the very first game against Boston College in 2006. So we'll win in Virginia, right?
I would think so. They were 4-8 last year. They're not a great team. Yeah. So
I think that's one of our wins we can say will for sure be a win.
One win. All right. Texas, that game, they're coming off a huge, you know, a really good Alamo Bowl victory. Their defense looked really good there in the second half. It looks like they found their quarterback in David Ash. He played very well, had two very, very good throws there in the second half for touchdown passes. I think that we look at this one, tough game, but probably a loss.
It's tough.
It's at home, so anything's possible.
And the other thing is that they have look-ahead games. They have Kansas State on deck and Ole Miss. Texas does. And so you can't go into Provo not prepared and looking, obviously, to win the game. But, I mean, Texas, I don't think this BYU game is, you know, on the top of their list going into next season. And so I wouldn't be surprised if it's really close and it really just comes down to the wire. I also think when we played that we should have beat them when Heaps was quarterback two seasons
Definitely.
Ago in Texas. And I think BYU has a little revenge kind of juice and factor that's going to play a role for those guys that are still on the team. And yeah, I wouldn't be surprised actually if this is the one game that we probably shouldn't win that we do get the W.
So you're saying that if we do beat Texas, we're going to lose against Virginia and Utah.
That's probably what is going to happen somehow, but yes.
Okay, so Texas is kind of on the fence. We have some good motivating factors there. Utah, I want to say that's a I mean, I'm not going to say that we will, but it's a must win. Like, we have
absolutely
to win this game.
That's a coaching for your job kind of game, honestly. I don't know. I mean, the tide might turn a little bit. If BYU were to start the season 1-2 with losing to Utah for the fourth straight year, the tide might start to turn a little bit. I mean, Broncos seat, I don't know if they got hot this year, but you know, I think if they lose another game to Utah and start the season at 1-2, that might really turn the tide against Bronco Mendenhall to, you know, his name will actually seriously be, you know, people will start to wonder a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. So next few games after this, Middle Tennessee State, they're a tough team. They're very athletic, but I think it's a very winnable game. Utah State, that one's a tricky game because we've beaten them the last 2 years.
Barely.
Barely, and you know, in pretty dramatic fashion.
And they did beat us last time we played in Logan.
Yeah.
But also, we don't know how much the coaching change is going to affect that program as well.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to have Anderson, although they'll still have Chucky Keaton around. So.
They're Kerwin Williams is not going to be there. Robert Turbin's not going to be there. Yeah. So. I think it's pretty safe to say that should be a win as well. But of these next few, looking down. That, I mean, probably, you know, in the month of October, that's a trickier game. Georgia Tech, I think that's a very winnable game. If our defense can play like it did last year, I think that one is. And
there are all those stats about Bronco Mendenhall defenses versus the option the last couple years versus option teams. So BYU does traditionally defend the option well.
Yep.
You got to think that's after
one of
beating
the
them last week,
on the schedule.
It seems like you should be able to beat Georgia Tech at home.
There you go. Houston, I think it's the same thing. They didn't have
That'll be the trap game of the season.
You're calling that the trap game of the season?
Yeah,
they were 5-7 last year.
BYU doesn't necessarily defend five wide pass every play offense very well either.
Yeah.
That'll be the trap game with Boise State coming off of a great win against Georgia Tech at home. That one scares me. I think there's a chance we drop the Houston game.
There you go. I look back, and I know this isn't maybe the exact comparison, but I remember the Tulsa game in 2007, I believe. We had just come off of I can't remember what happened.
It was the game following the Oklahoma game.
No. This wasn't right. following
the
Oklahoma
game. Oh, you're talking about 2007, not 2009. You're right. That was
Tulane. This was 2007, and I remember I was actually on my mission, but I just remember going back and like watching a review of that season and kind of seeing what had happened. I think we had a good win against Arizona at home. And then we went and played Tulsa, and we lost 56-54. And it could be one of those games where, you know, we're feeling good. We go down in there, and they just put up lots of points. So we'll put that one as a potential trap game of the season. Boise State, I think, it's a very winnable game. I think that Boise State's going to be a lot better next year than they were this year.
Yeah, I'm intrigued to see how good their offense is. They were absolutely a mess this season. It's hard to see them be much worse.
Yeah,
so,
any worse.
Yeah, I think that's one of the more intriguing matchups of the year for me, especially if Boise State, based on their schedule, might be going into that game undefeated in like a top 10 team.
It is a game at home. Oh, you have to give us that. And that's another game. And if you actually look over the schedule, there's three or four games on here that I think BYU has a lot of motivation for. Obviously, I think a lot of the players remember, as we already mentioned, the Texas loss, which they should have won. Utah last 3 years, Boise State, which is a game they totally gave away last season by deciding to go for two. And then Notre Dame as well is a game they should have had last year. At least I imagine they should have had last year. So
you know,
I'm not sure if that game actually happened, but
I think we should note those four games now for listeners and just for our sake, because those are absolutely games where BYU should be more motivated. So look at these now. You got Texas, Utah, Boise State, and Notre Dame. Okay, and I believe three of those are at home.
Yep.
I am really, really, really intrigued to see how we do in those four games. If we go 0-4, 1-3, that's an issue, I think, and kind of goes more towards the Bronco Mendenhall, Ben maybe thinking that there's something down the road in the near future that needs to be done there, because those four games should be games BYU should be absolutely ready to play up for and games they can really win, which is what's interesting about the schedule is a lot of these are winnable games, if not all of them. And so anyway, I just want to note those four games. Let's keep those in mind come next season here in a few months. That's going to be really interesting to see. I think if we can go 3-1 in those games, then we're going to have a good shot to actually, you know, make a bowl game and and whatnot. But if we go 1-3 or even drop them all, then different story.
Yeah, good point. Just buzzing through the rest of the schedule. Wisconsin, that's a fantastic game because I think it's in a great environment up there at Camp Randall and in Madison. Playing against Gary Anderson and what will be a very good Wisconsin team. That, I mean, they don't have, you know, they don't, they're not going to have
Ball.
The, what's that?
They won't have Monty Ball anymore.
Yeah, they won't have Monty Ball. And the quarterback situation is still very shaky there. But they're always going to have linemen that are like 6'5 and 350 pounds that will just mow people over.
It's going to be interesting to see because Gary Anderson did such a great job with Utah State the last couple of years. It's going to be really interesting to see what he's able to do next year in the next couple of years with a program with the talent level of a Wisconsin, with the resources of a Wisconsin, you know, in a Big Ten school and all that. It is really going to be interesting to see what he's able to do with those kind of resources.
Yeah, absolutely. Idaho State, that game, win guaranteed.
Yeah,
bet my house on it.
Their only win this past year was against an FCS school. So
real quick, do you think Wisconsin beats us or does BYU beat Wisconsin?
I think that's my one.
I have a complete toss up in that one. I think Wisconsin has the edge because of the home team, but aside from that, it's great that we have a bye week ahead of that to prepare for them.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, it sets up nicely for us, and so
again, the Gary Anderson thing adds a wrinkle to it, though, because it'd be one thing if you're going into Wisconsin and it's that kind of thing where, hey, they've never played us before, we've never played them before, we can go in there and maybe do something that'll shock them. And instead, you know, Gary Anderson knows the playbook. He knows what Bronco's going to do defensively. He's played even against the Robert and I teams. Like, he kind of knows what BYU is going to be doing. And so it just adds a whole other wrinkle to that game that I think kind of gives Wisconsin the advantage.
Yeah, I think they have the edge. So I think Wisconsin wins. I just wanted to make sure that you guys are on the same page or not. So anyway, Notre Dame, what do you guys think?
I want this game so bad.
Yeah.
I think that it's a very winnable game as well. Just based on what we saw last year, the only thing that I wouldn't say concerns me. I mean, their defense loses a few guys, but their offense coming – and their offense also as well. They lose Theo Riddick, and I think they lose Sierra Woods as well. And their tight end, Tyler Eifert, he's going to be a first-round draft pick. And so the only thing – I mean, just Everett Golson coming back, he's going to be a lot better having all of spring camp to get to know the playbook and everything. And we saw what he did against Oklahoma last year. I was not convinced that he was a very good quarterback, but he systematically drove them down the field, made big throws on third down. And so, towards the end of next year, I mean, maybe he's even better than we.
He's going to be a sophomore next year. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So I think other than him, the team's worse by far. I mean, I think they were the luckiest team in the entire nation this year.
Oh, without question.
And they weren't very good. I mean, BYU obviously was able to exploit them to an extent on the road. So other than Golson, I think that they're going to struggle. The defense won't be as good, like you said. Their running game, which was actually kind of problematic and had issues for a lot of the season anyway, won't be as good with Sierra Woods leaving. And so, yeah, I think that's, once again, another winnable game and one that we should be motivated for. I guess it really comes down to how Notre Dame, having an entire season, it might be the last game of the year for them. They might have one more after that, but you know they'll have a whole year to prepare. And so, by that time, you know, they might be gelled and things might be rolling a different way. And they might be on the cusp of, you know, two loss season, maybe another BCS bowl or whatnot. And so it'll be interesting to see kind of how the situational spots play at that point.
It's also,
it's hard to tell.
It is going to be interesting. That Notre Dame team is going to be interesting next year anyway, because I do think the kind of Manti Te'o thing is going to hang over them a little bit. That story's not going away. I mean, it's never going away. People are going to be making jokes about that for forever. But it is going to be interesting to see how they bounce back from that next year, because you know after every game, the questions they're going to get before and after the games are going to be about that at times. So I think that it is going to be interesting to see how that story kind of hangs over them next year and how they respond to it, because it could be the kind of thing where they come out and have a great season and respond to kind of adversity and all that. Or it could be the kind of thing where it's just kind of a nasty, you know, cloud that hangs over the team the whole year.
They have a great coach.
Definitely.
I think they will bounce back. It's going to be hard to see them, you know, just completely falling off the map in one season with a quarterback that'll be a lot more mature, like Jake had already pointed out. But yeah, it's going to be a really interesting season for that team, just in general, for any college football fan.
So last game of the season at Nevada and playing in Reno. This is the Kyle Van Noy send-off game. And
it's also the second trap game on my list. If we were able to beat Notre Dame or lose a close one and we're, you know, 6-5, it's a big letdown spot, I think.
Well, and then, you know, you don't want to catch BYU looking ahead to the Kraft Fight Hunger Bowl. So
that's true.
Heyo.
A lot of weight being held on that one. But yeah, I would pick BYU to win, gun to my head, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's, you know, 3-7.
Nevada was a bowl. I mean, Nevada did make a bowl game last year. I think they lost to Arizona, but you know, they were a pretty good team last year. So not a winnable game, but not one that you look at and you're immediately like, oh, that's a win.
Yeah. Especially just, I think, because of the situational spot, but when it comes down to it, I know I actually mentioned last week, it'll be hard to make it to a bowl game. And I think we really nailed it. It's going to be those four games against Texas, Utah, and Boise State at home, and then the Notre Dame one. If we can win two of those, I think then we'll make a bowl game.
Yeah, I think
if we don't, then it's going to be tough.
I think 9-3 would be a great accomplishment with this schedule for BYU, especially considering with Taysom Hill, you know, as a quarterback coming in as a sophomore. If they were to do 9-3,
let me tell you,
maybe the best coaching job BYU's had. Yeah, go ahead.
So, yeah, really interesting schedule, really quality schedule. Like I said, high-level games, winnable games. A lot of it, I mean, like the four games of intrigue that Preston's going to call them, the keys to the season. It's, you know, we're excited for it, and I think it'll be a lot of fun to be a part of the season. And I don't think there's going to be any point where we're – I mean, there's a few times, I mean, definitely in 2011 and then again in 2012 – where it's these lulls where we're playing, you know, the whack teams. And we definitely don't have it this year, and just really excited about what we have moving forward. So anyway, keep on the football subject. We have a very important game. And this is something that I've learned in advertising.
The big one.
Ladies and gentlemen, you cannot say the words Super Bowl on anything branded or anything like that.
Yeah, you have to say the big game, right?
Yeah, it's so funny because they say that for there's a Samsung commercial, which actually is pretty funny, where they talk about that, and it's been spreading around the world of advertising pretty quickly today. But it's basically Paul Rudd and Seth Rogen talking about this advertising exec basically being like, so we have to call it the El Plato Grande, and it's the San Francisco 51 minus tours and the Baltimore Blackbirds. And that's pretty much what it is. Like we've been doing some like online work, and basically, we had to change some stuff around because we actually said Super Bowl, but now we changed it around where it's a mac and cheese bowl that makes it super. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, actually. It's like, it makes about as much sense as the NBA League Pass blackout rules. Like, it's really stupid.
Well, essentially what it is they want to, they think, the NFL assumes that their trademark, that if you say Super Bowl, that the brand equity and that they're sponsoring, that the Super Bowl has somehow made a connection with such a fine brand that, you know, it's like, oh, they're increasing their brand equity just by associating with our fine spectacle of sport.
Everyone says it anyway. It's so dumb.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So if you look around, this is just anyone who's still listening. If you ever look around on the internet and you see things, it's like, hey, check this out for the big game. You know that they're not official NFL Super Bowl sponsors.
Or like you'll see commercials with like tweet about whatever or like log on to whatever during the big game. Like they never say Super Bowl. Yeah, it's annoying.
Lawyers ruining the world for us. Anyway, speaking of El Partido Grande, who do you guys got? What are you thinking for this game on Sunday?
I was going to let Preston go first. I'll say I think – and I don't really have necessarily great reasoning why, but I just have a gut thing about Baltimore, actually. Everyone – it seems like – I don't know what the line is or what you know, who's favored and all that, but it seems like most people –
Either do
seem,
I.
It seems like most people seem to be into the Niners. And I don't know. I just have – I kind of have a gut feeling that Baltimore is going to pull this one out. They have the better quarterback. They have a comparable, if not as good, but a veteran defense, and they are well coached. I just have a hard time. I don't know. For whatever reason, my gut's telling me Baltimore wins.
How'd you guys like that awkward sense of silence there. I wanted to test Ben and see how long you would wait until he jumped in. I thought that was funny. But that was only funny to me because everyone else thought it was absolutely weird. So the Baltimore Ravens pick, I 100% agree with.
Interesting.
For a lot of reasons. And I could get into this as in-depth or not in-depth as we need to. But basically, okay, Joe Flacco gets a lot of heat. And he's an outstanding postseason. He's now beaten Peyton Manning on the road, Tom Brady on the road, and now he's playing
Colin Kaepernick,
a rookie quarterback out of Nevada in the Super Bowl. Not sure why he can't beat Colin Kaepernick. Their defense is veteran. Ever since Ed Reed has come back, they haven't given up a deep touchdown over 16 yards through the year. They kind of have that mysterious, kind of like what Ben was saying, you know, destiny type feel to them. That touchdown against Denver to force overtime to Jacoby Jones with 70 yards or whatever. I mean, that should never have happened. Those types of things just add up to that destiny feel.
Not unlike the Giants last year a little bit.
Yeah, it really is kind of the same thing. They opened 5.5-point underdogs, and it's like 3 or 3.5 now. So a lot of people were betting the Ravens and moved the line down. So it's supposed to be a close game, and I think it will be. Another reason, I mean, I can keep going. David Akers might be one of the weirdest swings a kicker in the professional level has ever had from one season to the next. And he's been absolutely awful this year. So many misses. He clanked one off the post, I think, in the NFC title game. Luckily, it didn't end up, you know, biting him. But you can't count on him at all at any point in the Super Bowl. And so when it comes down to it, the 49ers, if they're, you know, kicking a 35-plus yarder, but it's 4th and 3, maybe they end up going for it when they shouldn't have. And it's just going to end up becoming an issue, especially if Akers kicks one early on and misses. Then you have no trust in him going forward. It's the biggest game of the season. I mean, I'll take the rookie Tucker from Baltimore, who's been great all
really
season,
good
over Akers. So there's just a lot of things that I think Baltimore is the better team. Actually, on top of it, they have a better running back in Ray Rice, although he's kind of been slowed down. But that's why Flacco's been able to step up and make a lot of plays. Dennis Pitta has been a great option to have kind of over the middle. He's made a couple great catches for them in this little mini playoff run. So he's the BYU Cougar shout out. But I am with Ben. The Ravens will win the game, probably, you know, between 3 or 7 points. It's not going to be a blowout, I think, on either side. It's going to be a fun Super Bowl and one that comes down to the fourth quarter.
Let me ask you guys this. In terms of your rooting interest, did Alex Smith being on the 49ers change you one way or the other? Because a part of me wanted to root for the 49ers, or wants to root for the 49ers, just so to have that shot where, like, the Tom Brady, Drew Brees shot, where Colin Kaepernick wins the game and he comes over to hug Alex Smith and he just looks so angry. Then on the other hand, I don't know if I want Alex Smith to have a Super Bowl ring. So,
it's a kind of an intriguing contrast for me. I grew up with no team in LA. And my dad, because of Steve Young, he was a 49ers fan. So I actually grew up kind of rooting for the 49ers. But I've never been a guy that just kind of jumps bandwagons back and forth. I've always said I don't really have an NFL team because I just never had one in Los Angeles. And so although I rooted up until the point, maybe I was 8 or 9 with my dad, I fell off the band. And then I had we talked about this before on the podcast, you guys have left, but you know, Kyle Buller was a quarterback in my high school, and I looked up to him as the quarterback, and he went to Cal, and then he went and played for the Ravens. And so I actually was a Ravens fan for a while because I was rooting for Kyle Buller to do well, and because I didn't really have a team. And
I still
recently,
think he never got a fair shot.
He went to St. Louis, and they were so bad. And he's always just been like a routine backup now. But yeah, that's another story. But anyway, so I've kind of, Now a couple years ago, I was like, I'll pick the Lions just because they are absolutely awful, and I think they might be good in the near future. And so I've just kind of rooted for teams for the sake of fun. Anyway, so both of these teams, if there's ever two teams that I've really been a true fan of, I mean, the 49ers and the Ravens are actually two of them. And so for me, it is hard to actually pick one. It's hard to, I don't know, is this Ray Lewis thing? I think it's worth discussing for a minute. Oh, he's going to retire, and so he needs to win his Super Bowl. Is that kind of getting overplayed now? You know, he's crying and thanking God like Tim Tebow after every game.
After that last game where he was collapsed with like 40 reporters and cameras all around him, yeah, and was like praying for like 30. So, I mean, I was actually watching that game. We were just laughing at it.
The 49ers.
Yeah, that whole element of it is ridiculous, I think, because he's obviously playing that up with the whole, you know, falling down and crying and all that stuff. Right. But that being said, I'd really like to see Joe Flacco maybe get a little bit of redemption, you know, kind of be validated, I guess, a little bit, because I think he's been good.
But yeah.
And I think, you know, I think he, for a while, he got put in that Tony Romo category of quarterbacks, of like a guy who was good but was never going to be able to, was like never going to maybe get you to the Super Bowl. And I just think he took a big leap this year, and I like him. So almost for that storyline, I'd like to see the Ravens win.
What pushes me over the edge to choosing Baltimore is this. The 49ers, I mean, what Harbaugh's done with them and turned them around after doing the same thing for Stanford, been incredible. And I think they're a real systematic, you know, defensive team. They're also younger. I think this is the Ravens' last chance to win a Super Bowl. If they don't get in now, I don't think.
Yeah, you're right. This group really probably isn't making it back.
The 49ers are going to be back there in the next 5 years. I would, you know, bet my house on that. They're going to be back there. They're a great team and they're well coached.
You have a house?
I think this is the Ravens' one shot. And so I kind of am rooting and pulling for them for that sake.
I don't know if I so much agree with that. I mean, I think the only two players that are seriously saying, you know, that could retire after this season would be Ed Reed and Ray Lewis. Aside that, I mean, you got Haloti Ngata, who's got definitely a few more years left with him on the defensive line, who's just an absolute stud. Paul Kruger's, you know, doing really well for them.
But they lost Ed Reed and Ray Lewis, and Terrell Suggs is declining and injured all the time too. And if you look at advanced stats, Ray Rice this year has been pretty
mediocre,
below average, and mediocre as the season's winding down. Like, his number of carries is kind of up, and they have no real threat at receiver. Torrey Smith and Jacoby Jones, Anquan Boldin. I don't know. I mean, they kind of. I mean, in reality, I don't know if they're as talented as the 49ers are. And they're definitely older. So, I mean, you can disagree. That's fine. I don't see them getting back there next year.
I would agree that I think
ahead of Denver.
Yeah, it seems like this might be their last, this group's last chance. Not that Baltimore couldn't get back somehow.
Yeah.
But I do feel like it's kind of this group's last chance. I mean, really, when you look at the 49ers, the only guys who you're looking at that, it seems like their last shot. I mean, maybe Randy Moss, but do you really want Randy Moss getting a Super Bowl ring? You know.
Ooh, that brings up a valid point. I don't know how I feel about Randy Moss being like Super Bowl champion.
So, Jake, it sounds to me like you're maybe leaning more towards the Niners, since Preston and I both kind of went with the Ravens.
No, this is the thing. I've been pulling for the Ravens, even secretly, when I was here in Colorado, when everyone was going banana nut crazy over the Broncos and stuff. And I was watching the game, and I was just like, wouldn't it be kind of fun if the Ravens won this thing? And they did, and ever since then I've been, you know, just pulling for that, mostly just to see Dennis Pitta do well, I think, like all of us have. And I didn't want New England to make it again. And so I'm glad to see them make it there. With the 49ers, you know, they're a good team. I don't think I have any specific reason to pull, you know, there's no guy on that team that I'm really cheering for that I'm like, yeah, I really like this guy. I really like the way that he plays.
I like Vernon Davis.
Yeah, I mean, there's some good players there, but there's no one that I really pull for. Yeah. I think I like the Ravens, A, because of Dennis Pitta, but Ray Rice went to Rutgers, New Jersey kid. Also, Joe Flacco is from Cherry Hill, New Jersey as well. So
it's also worth saying, I want to add that if you go back and listen to a PB&J report we did right at the beginning of the NFL season, I did pick the 49ers and Ravens to make the Super Bowl.
And
so this is actually
and you got the World Series.
And
right,
I got the World
baseball.
Series right, which has never happened to me before. So somehow I've got
who
two in a row right.
Pick Detroit or San Francisco before
I,
the season?
I picked Detroit to play San Francisco, and I don't remember. However, I mean, I don't remember if I picked Detroit or San Francisco.
Might have nailed both of these. I think you picked Baltimore before the year.
I think I did pick Baltimore, though, because I actually thought Baltimore should have won that game last year. Against the Patriots. I mean, they should have made the Super Bowl last year. Yeah. And then I kind of felt like at the beginning in the preseason, they were maybe not getting as much, you know, everyone was talking about, okay, the Patriots make it back. Well, I mean, the Denver story was so out of control, and the Jets, no one was really talking about Baltimore. And I just kind of felt like all season long, they were under the radar a little bit. And I kind of all season long was kind of secretly hoping like they would make it, just first off to fulfill my prediction, but second off because I kind of seem for more or less like a lot of the guys on the team. So,
right. So real quick then, because I don't think we had a podcast before NBA season started, Maybe we did, and I spaced it. But did you pick an NBA Finals?
I did. I picked. I don't remember if I picked one on the podcast, but I do believe I picked.
Let's do it now, so we have record, because you might go 3 for 3.
I mean, it's not that hard. I would have picked Miami and Oklahoma City. I think my argument. Maybe we did make this argument on the podcast, but when everyone thought the Lakers might be a team to challenge Oklahoma City in the West, my kind of argument was I don't think the Lakers could stop what Russell Westbrook, and that would kind of determine the series. And so and Miami's obviously a no brainer. So I would have picked Miami and Oklahoma City, which would still be my pick. That would probably be everyone's pick right now. It's hard to argue against either one of those teams.
Is Miami a no brainer?
Yeah, that's a no brainer, man.
I want
Dude,
so
you watched that game last
be,
night. You watched that game last night, and that team, I don't know if I've ever seen an NBA team, we're totally transitioning to another topic now, but I don't know if I've ever seen an NBA team that a team that maybe any sport that turns it off and on so much at will. They have those quarters where they're just like da 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 da, and no one's really trying hard, and they're kind of, and then it's like, oh, okay, now it's time to go, and like they just turn it on, and their defense all of a sudden locks down, and all of a sudden LeBron is like penetrating and dishing to just shooters everywhere, and it's just hard. Ray Allen's played so well. Battier is such a good shooter right now still. It's just hard for me to see any team in the East beating them, especially with Rondo out. I thought
the Chicago Bulls when Derrick Rose comes back.
Yeah, but I think that's such a toss-up as to what, you know, how good is he going to be. If he comes back and he's Derrick Rose, then
even without
then definitely
him, they're the second best team in the East.
Then definitely. Yeah, so but
they
they're
him.
Without him, they're not even
Ray
close.
Ray Allen gets a foot injury and can't play. And Derrick Rose and the Bulls are Derrick Rose and the Bulls.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think one key injury to Miami could change, swing things. Bosch being out, maybe.
But
I don't
that's
know.
True. But if you're just looking at the way things are at this moment, I do think Miami's a no-brainer. I agree. Like, if Derrick Rose comes back and he's exactly what he was, during his MVP year, and Joakim Noah, how well he's played, and Deng's played really well. And Boozer randomly has played pretty well.
Season of his life.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have the option, I think, of being the other team that could contend for the East. But that's, I think, there's a lot of ifs there. And Carlos Boozer has had great regular seasons before and choked in the playoffs. So I wouldn't count on Carlos Boozer as a Jazz fan. I've been there and done that. So I still think, even with all that being said, even with a Ray Allen, like in your scenario, let's say Ray Allen gets injured and Derrick Rose comes back and is Derrick Rose, I would still favor the Miami Heat over the Chicago Bulls. I would still say they're the favorite. It's not as big of a gap, but I'd still think they would be the favorites. They're so good when they want to be. Like,
they're my picks.
They're
too.
So good when they want to be.
Trying to play devil's advocate. My pick in the West, by the way, is the Spurs.
Really? I think Oklahoma City figured the Spurs out last year. I think in the playoffs they figured it out.
Sure, if shooting 70% can continue. And now you don't have James Harden either, so good luck.
I just think they figured out.
They got really, really hot, and then the Miami Heat got really, really hot against the Thunder in the finals. And I mean, the team that shot 80% from three won the games.
they did shoot ridiculous numbers from threes in that series.
Both series were
That was a massive tangent from the Super Bowl, though.
No, those are great.
It was good because you really did nail the World Series and now the Super Bowl. And so I just wanted to get your picks for the NBA Finals.
Yeah, I would still say Miami and Oklahoma City. Although, we can transition over to the NBA even more. But the West is really interesting right now, I think. I mean, we were talking about on Twitter before the podcast, but I think the West is really, really intriguing.
So the one thing that you guys kind of mentioned before that you wanted to talk about, real briefly, was the trade that Memphis made. And there's been a lot of people saying that, okay, this doesn't really benefit anyone a whole lot. Other people saying this is huge for Memphis. Quick grade for you guys on this. Does this really help Memphis and make them, sustain that, a top four? Can they sneak into the top three? Or are they kind of just the same team?
Well, it's interesting because the 99.9% of the people that are following this trade or saw it on ESPN or saw the names would be like, what was Memphis doing? Because Rudy Gay is a name. He's a star. He's more flashy, and they don't get that they traded him for this guy named Ed Davis and then an old veteran washed up Tayshaun Prince and another young guy in a pick. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. But Rudy Gay, one thing is interesting. John Hollinger was hired on to be Memphis's, for one of their front office guys.
Right.
I don't think he technically starts till this next season, but I'm sure they've been in contact with him. And the first major move they made immediately after getting Hollinger, just, you know, getting his thought, and is trading Rudy Gay, who 2 years ago without Rudy Gay, Memphis is an 8 seed, upset the Spurs in the first round, took the Thunder to 7 games. And I think they lost a triple overtime game in game 6 that would have probably swung things, or maybe it was game 5, but I mean, it could have gone either way. Then they're better without Rudy Gay. They have been. Now, it helped that they had OJ Mayo off the bench, and they do lack OJ Mayo off the bench now. But they upgraded over Darrell Arthur, getting Ed Davis, who's a double-double guy, and he's only 25. He's going to be good off the bench. Austin Day's another young guy. He, believe it or not, shoots 52.5% from three this year on 2 attempts a game almost, in almost 14 minutes a game is all. So he, you know, he's not in rhythm all the time. He's just coming off the bench, and he's shooting over 50% from three. He's not known to be a three-point shooter, so maybe it's fluky and he'll regress. But that's just a side note. But hey, I think it's actually a great trade for Memphis, A-plus across the board for getting rid of a guy that was maybe a locker room issue, an ISO ball stopper type guy, and then bringing in a defender, veteran, team player, intangibles guy in Tayshaun Prince. And I think Memphis was probably not going to be making a run at winning the title anyway. And so, I mean, I don't think it really makes them much worse or much better. But what it does do, I think, is change the chemistry and the attitude that surrounds the team and the direction that it's going, opens up cap space down the road, getting rid of that Rudy Gay $17 million and $19 million the next 2 years, which is ridiculous for a guy that's not really an all-star, in my opinion. Anyway, so those are my thoughts. I think when it comes down to it, they're probably not going to win the West anyway. I think the Clippers are fraudulent, like I've said before. So I think Memphis could still get out the 3 seed. Either way, at that point they'll probably lose in the second round to the Thunder or the Spurs, though. So, yeah, those are my thoughts. It's an interesting trade. What's crazy is the West has so many good teams. You know, the Clippers, the Warriors, and the Nuggets are going to be a 4, 5, 6 seed, or potentially the Grizzlies a 4, 5, 6 seed, and the Lakers an 8 seed, or the Mavs an 8 seed, and the Jazz 7, 8 seed may not even make the playoffs. I mean, Portland and Houston are both solid teams. I mean, the West is so stacked, and just from 1 to 12. I mean, the Kings and Suns are pretty awful, but anyway, I think it's going to be a great finish as far as NBA fans just watching the game in general go.
Well, I have to say, I'm a little more hesitantly optimistic than you are. I think this was a really great trade long-term. Kind of like you said, Rudy Gay was making an obscene amount of money. So I do think long-term this gets rid of that contract. It frees up some cap space for them. It lets them, and it also let them get a little deeper, because that the team's biggest problem was their bench, really, recently. Mm-hmm. Especially with, you know, they got rid of OJ Mayo, and their bench just wasn't as deep as it was the last couple seasons. That being said, I do think in the short term, with Rudy Gay on the roster, their ceiling, I think, was a little higher than what it is right now with Tayshaun Prince. Like, you could have envisioned a scenario in which maybe they made a run to the conference finals with Rudy Gay, and I don't think that's really going to happen with Tayshaun Prince on the team.
Funny is the advanced stats and the
Hollingers, right, say that they would get more wins.
And the eye test from 2 years ago say that they actually have a better chance.
Yeah, but
that
was 2 years ago. Look at, I mean, Zach Randolph's not the same guy he was that 2 years ago. His stats.
But Marc Gasol and Mike Conley are better.
Mike Conley's definitely better. Marc Gasol's having a bit of a down season offensively. I think he's shooting like 47% from the field. One thing I'm going to be interesting to see, looking at kind of the advanced numbers, is I do believe, you know, if you look at like the per 36 numbers, Tayshaun Prince averages like 4 shots less per game than Rudy Gay. And so if you imagine, okay, basically Memphis takes 4 shots Rudy Gay was taking, and you kind of distribute them out somewhere. If you give those 4 shots
probably
to
in the post.
Right, if you give those 4 shots to Marc Gasol and Rudy Gay, I mean, and Zach Randolph, then maybe they're able to make up those points offensively. But Rudy Gay is the kind of guy who maybe on a given night could explode. He's the kind of, you know, he was a weak defender, but he could kind of explode maybe on a given night if he got hot from three or something. So I do think maybe their ceiling isn't as high. But that being said, I think you're right. I don't think they were going to make a run. I don't think they were going to make it to the finals with the team as it was constituted.
Shooting better this year from the field than last season.
Is
and get this, 88% from the free throw line for a big that gets there 4 or 5 times a game.
I love
insane.
Watching his pass. I think he's such a good passer from the post. It's really fun to watch. No, but I just think that I don't think their ceiling is maybe as high, but I don't think also they were going to make it to the finals anyway. So might as well get rid of Rudy Gay and get open up that cap space, because maybe next year they're able to sign a good veteran guard or someone to kind of make up some more points. And maybe in the years to come they're able to sign some guys up to pair with Randolph and Gasol. So I think they win the trade overall. I mean, certainly better than what Toronto did. And I guess people seem to like that Detroit got an expiring contract, but it's not a great roster move. So anyway, I think it's a great long-term move for Memphis. I don't know how much it's going to affect them in the short term, but long-term it's the right decision.
I think the matchups in the playoffs. I mean, if they get up, you know,
the West is going to come down to matchups as it is. I mean, like you said, like we were talking about earlier on Twitter, I do think, you know, a 4-5 Memphis Golden State series could be really, really interesting.
That's what it looks like it's going. My prediction is that the Clippers fall back, but as of now, it does look like Golden State Memphis would be the fourth.
It depends on Chris Paul's injury, too, because now, what are we on? It's 3 or 4 games that he's missed in a row now with that knee. And it's
what I heard?
How many years are we going to see this with Chris Paul, you know?
Supposedly Chris Paul did this same exact thing when he was on the Hornets and then eventually needed like reconstructive knee surgery and was out for the year. He kind of like let him on for a couple weeks and tried to just rest it or something. I don't know. People are now, there's rumors that it's a lot worse than.
Well, he did. This happened last year too, where he was out for a while, I think, with the sore knee. So, I mean, the Clippers are still, I think the Clippers, even without Chris Paul, are a playoff team just because Bledsoe's played so well. But it's hard to, I mean, they definitely would drop out of the top four if Chris Paul's out, you know, long term.
What do you think, Jake?
I think that Preston Johnson can be our official doomsday predictor, with Taysom Hill being out for the next 3 years, Chris Paul having reconstructive surgery, Derrick Rose not being his best self. No, obviously the team that I'm intrigued about, and I'm being the homer here, is the Denver Nuggets. They've won, you know, like they've won 5 straight. They've won 8 out of their last 10. They're playing good teams, and obviously playing a lot of teams at home, and they're winning the games at home. But I think that, you know, if they're able to get up there into the top four, which I potentially, you know, they're a game behind Memphis, so they could definitely get up into home court advantage there. So I'm just curious to see how this team comes together, because I watched them a lot in the beginning of the season and they're completely disjunct. And I think they finally figured out, with this new kind of nucleus of guys, with Andre Iguodala, you know, and getting Wilson Chandler now to kind of round out their bench there. I think they're a really strong team. You know, they finally got back to where it's like, okay, now we have 10 guys again that we can trust and put on the floor and really run guys up and down. Ty Lawson's playing a lot better. He had a really, really rough start to the season. He was turning the ball all over the place, and he wasn't shooting at a high percentage. He's playing a lot better now. I think he's kind of trusting the guys around him. Danilo Gallinari is actually playing efficiently on offense, which is mind-boggling to me, because if they can do that, if all these guys can kind of like keep on playing at this level and Andre Iguodala can keep playing great perimeter defense, then they're a really intriguing matchup to any team, I think, in the Western Conference. And that's my rant about that.
But do you see them? I mean, odds are they're going to be the 6th seed, right?
They're a half game behind Golden State, and they're 1 game behind Memphis.
I personally think Golden State and Memphis are better. I mean, Preston's argument about the Clippers being fraudulent, maybe. I mean, that's going to depend on Chris Paul. But
yeah. Well, and I just think their bench is going to regress a ton.
Maybe. I
just don't see Matt Barnes and Lamar Odom and – well, Eric Bledsoe, but now he's starting. But anyway, that's it's a different story, because I don't think any of the 3 teams have a real shot.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, I sort of disagree. I think their bench is their bench. But I mean, maybe Matt Barnes will wrestle, because he's played
Jamal
out
Crawford,
of his mind.
Like, that's another guy. He's been unreal, borderline all-star careering it. There's no way he continues shooting that well off of a 2 straight years shooting barely 40%. Now he's shooting, you know, 47. I mean,
I think there's a chemistry issue, though, there with Jamal Crawford, where he did not fit in Portland last year, and in what was Atlanta the year before. I mean, he was having I think there was a chemistry issue there that I think he's fitting in with this Clipper team. That is why he's playing so well. I don't think it's necessarily I don't think it's necessarily that it's like a freak outlier occurrence. I think it's just he's in a better headspace. He's on a team that he fits in perfect with.
I watched Matt Barnes play for a couple of years.
Yeah, that's
and
one
he
that could regress.
Stop hitting 5 threes a game one day.
Yeah, that's a guy that could clearly regress. But I mean, let's say I don't know. I find it hard to see. I think kind of the top five is the top five. I don't know if any of those teams are going to drop out of it. And so if Denver's the sixth seed, I mean, they're going to end up playing either Oklahoma City or San Antonio. And
I don't really see them beating one
of those teams in the first round.
No, I don't think so. And here's what comes down to me, though, with the Clippers. Do you really, honestly, for your low post front court presence, trust Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan, and Lamar Odom?
DeAndre's played well.
Think about that for a second. DeAndre Jordan doesn't even play in the fourth quarter anymore. Lamar Odom gets his minutes late.
Yeah, but also Lamar Odom, I mean, this is not a case of where Lamar Odom's playing freakishly well and you're like, he's going to regress. Lamar Odom regressed the last 2 years, and all of a sudden he's been playing steadily better as the season progresses here.
So do you really trust him and Blake Griffin?
He might be just coming
back
into shape.
You still aren't even asking my question or answering the question. I mean, you got Tim Duncan and the Spurs. You have Marc Gasol and Zach Randolph.
I don't think they're winning the West or anything.
Ibaka, and you got Ali. And I know. I'm just saying their front court. I don't think you can trust even against a team like Denver. I just don't know how.
Wait, so you're trusting JaVale McGee?
Absolutely,
JaVale McGee. I do love Fareed.
And.
But Fareed also can't hit free throws.
They're guys that actually just hustle and are athletic.
Yeah, but Fareed also can't hit free throws. I mean,
whoa. You
can Griffin and DeAndre Jordan?
He was 7-for-8 the other night.
And can Griffin and DeAndre Jordan?
No, but I mean it's a wash.
They're worse.
It's a wash.
I just
and Chris Paul is definitely better than Ty Lawson, and I don't know. I think
Iguodala is better than everyone else, and Gallinari is better than everyone else. I mean, so it comes down to player by player matchups. I just don't think there's been ever, you know, a team that can actually contend or should be a top three seed. I mean, like that. Blake Griffin is so overrated, and DeAndre Jordan, Lamar Odom can't be your next best frontline players defensively, offensively, either of that. So maybe I only hate the Clippers just because they're in LA, but I just don't think they're that great. They went on that 19-game winning streak, which is the only reason they're at the three seed right now. So maybe the 19-game winning streak means they're actually legit, but I just don't see it.
Yeah.
Chris Paul's injury has also kept him. He was like borderline going to win the MVP, and now it's kind of that story's gone.
That's the thing. And also, it's worth noting this thing about Chris Paul is that, like, Chris Paul's only 27 years old, but he seems like a really old 27, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's had all these knee surgeries, and, like, he does not seem like he's 27 years old. I'm not so sure. You know, he's up for his contract's out at the end of this year. I'm not so sure it's a smart thing to sign Chris Paul to, like, a 5-year deal. I'm not sure Chris Paul is going to be playing at this level 2 years from now.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, you've seen other guys that have had injuries and come back for a couple seasons and been okay and explosive. But he's kind of just been nagged since that injury 3 years ago. And it happened when he was so young that, yeah, I think I can. Holy cow, what just happened? I think Jake fell asleep just now.
No, I think my microphone rubbed up against my nipple.
I think you're tired of the NBA talk after your Nuggets rant, so we'll go ahead and let you wrap this up.
That's going to be a new drop for next week's show.
As it should be. Anyway, let's wrap this thing up.
So we rambled about the NBA for a while there.
That was some fantastic rambling. I think maybe we dedicate an entire podcast just to NBA talk. But
we will. We will.
We will make it happen anyway. Thank you all for listening. Have a fantastic evening, day, whenever you listen to this. Good day.